From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We have used nuclear weapons to deter and to reassure by extending deterrence. That's our doctrine now. We don't have any intention of changing that doctrine.
That was U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter speaking at Kirkland Air Force Base in New Mexico Tuesday in response to a question from Colonel Brenda Cartier, commander of the U.S. Air Force 58th Special Operations Wing. Colonel Cartier asked if the U.S. nuclear arsenal could be used as not just a deterrence, but a currency of power.
As military members, we realize the destructive power of nuclear weapons and how those are clearly used to deter other nations. My question is this: is there a deeper theoretical way by which we use nuclear weapons as a currency of power? And you mentioned that other nations brandish these weapons or the technologies or the capabilities to maybe get to them in ways to affect our behavior and other nations' behavior. Do you believe that we as the United States can use them as a currency of power, as a subset of deterrence, and how might we do that?
That particular article of what is called soft power includes the U.S. current policy of maintaining a threat of a first strike. The Pentagon has refused to adopt a no-first-use nuclear policy, claiming the threat of a first strike deters nuclear attacks on the U.S. and its allies. Carter said the first strike policy contributed to the deterrence of war.
No one has found an effective defense against nuclear weapons. So the way we protect ourselves is through deterrence. That is a simple concept, but it's complicated to apply.
Those remarks follow media reports that President Barack Obama was weighing an overhaul of the longstanding policy. In response, there have been contradictory moves in Congress over the past week on this issue. 30 U.S. senators last week sent the president a letter urging him to retain the first strike option. The first strike policy figured in the debate Monday night between Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump and his Democratic counterpart Hillary Clinton. Clinton defended her support for the Iran nuclear deal and attacked Trump's previous comments, suggesting that the U.S. might benefit from such allies as Japan, South Korea, and Saudi Arabia developing their own nuclear weapons and leaving the U.S. nuclear umbrella.
His cavalier attitude about nuclear weapons is so deeply troubling. That is the number one threat we face in the world, and it becomes particularly threatening if terrorists ever get their hands on any nuclear material. So a man who can be provoked by a tweet should not have his fingers anywhere near the nuclear codes.
Trump, in turn, challenged previous support by Clinton of the first strike policy.
What Secretary Clinton was saying about nuclear with Russia, she's very cavalier in the way she talks about various countries. But Russia's been expanding. They have a much newer capability than we do. We have not been updating from the new standpoint. I looked the other night, I was seeing B-52s. They're old enough that your father, your grandfather could be flying them. We are not keeping up with other countries. I would like everybody to end it, just get rid of it. But I would certainly not do first strike. I think that once the nuclear alternative happens, it's over. At the same time, we have to be prepared. I can't take anything off the table.
Nevertheless, Democrats claimed that Trump was the greater danger. On Tuesday, two Democratic lawmakers reportedly introduced a bill that would bar the president from launching a nuclear first strike without a congressional declaration of war. They argued this was not in response to Carter's statements, but to protect the world from a launch by a President Trump. However, similar, though more tepid legislation has been pending and languishing in Congress since at least March 5th of 2003, when Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, introduced Senate Resolution 76, expressing the sense of the Senate that the policy of a preemptive first strike, combined with a policy of first use of nuclear weapons, creates an incentive for the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, especially nuclear weapons, and is inconsistent with the long-term security interests of the United States. Some nuclear states, including China, have declared a nuclear policy of no first use, but the U.S. and its NATO allies insist on retaining the right to launch a preemptive nuclear strike. That issue has received almost no coverage in U.S. media. Press TV's Kanish Fatima spoke with Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, about the U.S. first strike doctrine.
Mr. Bennett, this policy of not adopting the no first use nuclear policy is part of the U.S.'s deterrent policy, saying that it insists on its right to launch a preemptive nuclear strike. Does that keep America safe?
Well, it's very disturbing. It's one of the most disturbing things I've heard in all of my life, really, in all of the military days that I've had too. This is a representation of the American military at the Pentagon, the generals and the admirals, going completely out of control and manipulating the civilian appointed Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, and persuading him through nonsense bureaucratic papers and studies that are put out by Booz Allen Hamilton and the RAND Corporation and numerous defense contractors justifying the necessity of a first strike capability. And Ashton Carter siding with those morons in bureaucratic uniforms to assume a posture where now they are most likely going to be engaging in some sort of a first strike nuclear capability, most likely against Iran. That's what they're saying in code. And it's disturbing that it's even being talked about, but it's being put on the table. Now, it doesn't keep America straight safe. In fact, it threatens every American. It threatens Europe. It threatens the world. What it shows also is that the Obama administration, President Obama, is completely out of touch. John Kerry, the State Department Secretary, is out of touch. And Ashton Carter and the Defense Pentagon and the military bureaucrats at U.S. Central Command, which are completely off the chain, are carving out future job employment operations in endless war, and they're carving out potential wars in Syria and Iran. What Obama needs to do is immediately fire Ashton Carter, immediately fire the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of the Army, the Secretary of the Navy. The military brass generals need to be immediately replaced because they obviously are posturing the military-industrial complex and the Pentagon for some action post the election. And we could be entering a time between October and January where something very serious could happen, triggered by the military, in order to create a war situation for the next year.
Meanwhile, last week's bombing of the Syrian army by the U.S. brought the U.S. and Russia closer to war, as Russian airplanes provided cover for the Syrian forces. John Stepling is an author and political commentator based in Norway. Speaking with Press TV's Kovi Tavwe, he said,
"You have this U.S. attack of last week that was then described as a mistake by the U.S. government, I think. And Glenn Ford over at Black Agenda Report had a really interesting article about a possible split between the Pentagon and the White House over Syria policy. Now, whether that's true or not, I think it's clear that it's very hard for anybody to deny at this point that the U.S. Is funding a lot of the extremists fighting in Syria. Their desire has been to regime change, to get rid of Assad. And if there is a split between the Pentagon and the White House, it's because Hillary Clinton is the presumptive next president, and her policy has been, you know, very hawkish in terms of intervention. So, you know, all of this has to be the Syrian comments from the foreign minister, I guess it is, have to be seen in light of you know, the escalation of U.S. Interference in the region, and I think that Russia's, you know, disturbed by U.S. actions, and probably more than a little bit worried."
Quickly, if you can, I mean, we're looking at the fact that you have what is happening on the ground being termed, in one respect, as a regrouping. This is what Russia has said of these terrorists on the ground. You know, when it comes to the core of the issue, that's where the problem is, of which Russia has said, separate these terrorists from these so-called rebels. The U.S. has not complied. Did the U.S. expect any worse outcome than what it's seeing right now based on that decision?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the U.S., one of the standard refrains you hear from U.S. representatives is that they're supporting the moderate rebels in Syria, except that nobody can find these moderates. I'm very cynical about anything the U.S. says right now in regards to Syria. I just don't believe it. And there's an enormous amount of propaganda. You have to understand there's an enormous amount of propaganda that is disseminated in North America, certainly, and in Europe about Syria. I mean, they've hired PR people, the Purpose Organization and so forth. There's the whole white helmet story. And all of this is propaganda, and it's propaganda meant to obscure the reality of what's going on, which is, I think, that Assad is targeted for regime change.
Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford spoke with our regular political consultant, Professor Anthony Montero, about that.
2 weeks ago, U.S. warplanes attacked a Syrian military base, killing over 60 government soldiers who were fighting the Islamic State. We spoke with Du Boisian scholar and veteran political activist Dr. Anthony Montero and asked if he believed Washington's claim that the bombing was a mistake.
Well, of course not. It was not a mistake. It was the Pentagon's response to the ceasefire and peace accords, at least temporarily, between Lavrov and John Kerry, the Russian foreign minister, and the U.S. Secretary of State. And they were sending a message. Ash Carter and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dunford, they were sending a message that they don't want peace in Syria, that they're waiting until the election is decided, and then there will be a new approach to Syria where the United States will attempt to impose a no-fly zone, and even if that means confronting the Russian Air Force, which would mean a big power confrontation over Syria, which could easily spin out of control into something far bigger than anyone imagines, and would bring us, interestingly, close to a situation similar to what the world confronted in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis, a crisis that occurred almost 54 years ago now. So I think we're in dangerous territory. I think there is a deep split within the administration. For the most part, Obama is pretty much out of the picture. And then the State Department, the department that is supposedly dealing with diplomacy, is split. Because if you watch the performance over the weekend of U.S. UN Ambassador Samantha Powers, who walked out of the Security Council session called by the Russians to investigate the U.S. Air Force's bombing of the Syrian Arab Army's base. She walked out and attacked the Russians and blamed them for everything going on in Syria, literally blamed the Russians for the U.S. bombing of the Syrian Army, and in a very belligerent manner and a very hostile manner, made it clear that she, Samantha Powers, was on the side of Ash Carter, the U.S. Defense Secretary, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff in their preparation for war in Syria with Russia.
And the Russians were, of course, understandably alarmed. They asked the undiplomatic question of, who is in charge in Washington? The Defense Department? The Pentagon? Who?
Absolutely. You know, Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, held a press conference at the UN after he spoke there on behalf of the Russian Federation. And while he was attempting to be diplomatic, it was clear that he was raising the question of who was in charge. And that's what everybody is asking. Who's in charge in Washington? Now, obviously, I think it's obvious to me, it's not Obama. But clearly, the forces of war, the party of war, is waiting for the outcome of the election. And I'm certain most of them assume or are betting on Hillary Clinton being the next president. And of course, we know Hillary Clinton's position on Syria. As far back as 2011, she was calling for a no-fly zone and a type of Libyan solution to the West Syrian problem. And of course, Samantha Powers, who is the author of the Powers Doctrine of the right to intervene on so-called humanitarian grounds wherever the United States chooses to. And that was the doctrine that was used to justify the intervention in Libya. And once again, I would underline this right to intervene, which means that the United States could supersede international law and even the UN Security Council and take matters into its own hands. It is possible that if Clinton is elected, that Samantha Powers would either be her Secretary of State or perhaps her National Security Advisor. Nonetheless, it is clear that the Clinton foreign policy would be guided by the Pentagon and her own predisposition to settle accounts in the Middle East and with the Assad government and with Russia militarily.
As the former Defense Secretary Gates informed us, a no-fly zone is not just a declaration. U.S. military doctrine requires that when it declares a no-fly zone, it must then proceed to destroy the aircraft and anti-aircraft capability of the country that it's declared against. In Libya, that was just Gaddafi's forces. But in Syria, we're talking about Russians.
Oh, yeah. And as you know, the Russians not only have air bases in Syria, and I would add in Iran, that are used against ISIL and the al-Nusra Front and the other terrorist organizations, but the Russians some months ago installed in Syria F-300 anti-missile and anti-aircraft defense facilities. These are considered to be among the most advanced anti-aircraft defense facilities known in the world today. So I think that to enforce a no-fly zone in Syria would mean not only attacking the Syrian Air Force, but it would mean attacking the Russian Air Force and the Russian missile and air defense installations within Syria. That type of attack would be tantamount to a declaration of war or an act of war against Russia. As you already know, the tensions between Russia and the United States are not only in Syria, but certainly in Eastern Europe, in the Baltic states, where NATO and primarily U.S. forces are right on the borders of Russia. And of course, all of the talk about bringing Ukraine into NATO and the placing of U.S. nuclear-armed missiles in Poland and in other Eastern European countries only heightens this possibility of war between Russia and the United States. In fact, my opinion is that the most important question in this election is the question of war and peace. For that reason, I have felt for some time that Hillary Clinton has to be defeated no matter what it takes or whoever it takes to do it, because of the two major candidates, Hillary Clinton is, and the forces around her, and this big tent that she's now at the top of. This big tent is the tent of American imperialism, American militarism, and war with Russia and or China or both at the same time.
Well, what does the War Party, which is, of course, clustered around Hillary Clinton, what does it think it's about? There is clearly no war fervor in the United States. The Trump folks have not dumped their candidate because he said he was against regime change. And we don't see a great war fervor among the ranks of Democrats. Where is the sanction for this kind of saber rattling?
Well, you see, I think the Democratic Party is very sophisticated in using methods of distraction, of methods of saying one thing and, of course, doing the very opposite. Of course, Obama was the great distraction where he talked peace but pursued war and so on. But what they would do is to find every justification to say that the United States is threatened by Russia and to use a version of the Samantha Powers Doctrine to say that the Syrian population is threatened by the Russians and the Syrian army and so on, and thus the right to humanitarian intervention. But you're right. The people of the United States and the majority of the military in a recent study conducted by Military Times and Syracuse University found that 55% of the U.S. military strongly or somewhat opposes policies of continual war and regime change. So even at the level of the rank and file of the operational forces in the U.S. military, the majority are against the policies of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Pentagon, and the top brass of the military. So I can see this as a form of a political clash between classes. In other words, a reflection or manifestation of class conflict over foreign policy, over questions of war and peace, not to mention questions of neoliberal trade policies like TPP, which would immiserate and impoverish the American working class.
Well, let's be clear about which classes are intent on war.
The class intent upon war is the class represented by Hillary Clinton, and that is what we euphemistically call the 1%. We're talking about the financial oligarchy. And we're talking about that tiny section of the global population that sees the possibility of establishing a regime of domination of the world through its control of finance, cyber space, and of military forces. That's who we're talking about. On the other side are the majority of the people, and a growing majority, especially working people who have suffered under policies of war, austerity, and neoliberal globalization, i.e. policies of trade based upon treaties like NAFTA and Trans-Pacific Partnership and TIPP.
And the Russia-phobia has gone so far that the Clinton supporters seem to be saying that the Russians are about to disrupt the American electoral process.
Absolutely. And that is part of the propaganda of war. And if you understand it in this period or in previous periods of the Cold War, that you establish an external enemy, in this case Russia, previously the Soviet Union, which will then, and I put quotes, justify war and military buildup, and thus calling upon the American people to make sacrifices for security. Now, it's not just Russia. Russia is the main target, but it's also China. And interesting, North Korea and Iran. So we're getting to this thing of what the U.S. military planners call full-spectrum domination, their ability to wage multiple wars on multiple fronts with multiple adversaries. This is very dangerous. And Hillary Clinton and her big tent are the ones that are pushing this and think this is a realistic approach to world problems.
Yes, U.S. military planning calls for the U.S. to be able to wage 2.5 wars, 2 major wars with 2 major adversaries, and a half war with a smaller adversary. It seems like they're lining up their adversaries right now.
That's right. And the adversaries, if you want to call them that, are lining up to prepare to defend themselves. And, of course, you know, the newly emerging China-Russia strategic alliance, and now the China-Russia-Iran strategic alliance. I think they understand what Syria represents. And we heard only about a month ago that the Chinese are supporting the Russians in Syria. Of course, the Iranians have permitted the use of military or air bases in Iran to fly missions into Syria against ISIL and al-Nusra Front in defense of the Assad government. And what we're not yet clear upon is where will Turkey come down in all of this after the U.S. supported, at least after it was in process, the U.S. supported a failed coup d'etat against the Erdogan government.
So here domestically, we hear all kinds of talk about lesser evilism, but there can be no greater evil than the destruction of the world through war.
That's right. That's right. And we're talking about major powers, all of whom possess nuclear weapons. The Russians have already said that if NATO threatens the existence of their state, they have the right to use nuclear weapons. China has not said that, but they have called upon the U.S. Navy to back off in the South China Sea. The government of the Philippines, who went to the World Court, to The Hague, to challenge Chinese island building and occupation of islands in the South China Sea, and one in The Hague, has said politically, however, that they are with China against the United States and called for the United States Special Forces to leave the Philippines. So this is a very fluid situation. Now, will the forces of war in the United States be so foolhardy to challenge a emerging alliance of forces who disagree on many things, but agree on one thing, that they oppose American militarism and war and belligerency? Will the people like the Ash Carters and the Hillary Clintons and the Samantha Powers and on be so crazy as to push this thing beyond the point of no return? That's why I think we on the left, and especially the black left, have to begin to raise the question of war and peace as a central question in this election. Of course, the corporate media and the Clinton campaign wish to distract from that. We have to put those issues back at the center of the discussion in this upcoming election.
That was Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford speaking with our own political correspondent, Professor Anthony Montero. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.